Learning to read is literally mind-altering in that it rewires people's neurology and it does so permanently.
Literally brain-altering.
Yes, it's brain-altering, but it's consciousness-altering. And once you scale that up, it does very profound things.
So it sounds like I should learn to read.
What print did was it allowed scholars in the early modern era to externalize the material which previously they just stored in their minds.
Well, so but in the sense problem is we don't now store it in our minds.
That's right.
We store it in the cloud, we can retrieve it, but it's the exact opposite. In other words, not only are we not encouraged to memorize anything.
That's absolutely right.
We're discouraged from even thinking.
That's right. And what's potentially, I think, a grave risk is that whereas with a physical library, you can externalize your memory into a physical book, but that once the text is there and it's printed, it doesn't change. Whereas once text is stored in a digital space, and not in our minds and not in a printed book, it can change. What we refer to becomes fluid in a way which is really unsettling. You know, newspaper articles can be rewritten. Wikipedia entries can be updated on the we're already seeing the politics of this, aren't we?
Yes.
You know, everywhere, all the time. There's a sense that reality has become very sort of slippery underneath us.
Welcome to Socrates in the City, Socrates in the Studio edition, the city in which I find myself, along with millions of others today, is London, England. And a strange thing has happened. I came to the studio here. We're in a studio. We've booked a studio to do these events and to do these interviews. And I thought I would be interviewing someone. But we also have Mary Harrington, as you know, interviews people for Socrates in the city. And so she's turned up as well. And there are no guests. And so Mary and I thought maybe we could just talk to each other. Mary, do you mind?
Not at all, Eric.
And if anybody minds, they'll soon tune out if they haven't already done so.
Or yell at us in the comments.
Yes. Well, you're the only person besides me who's ever conducted Socrates conversations. And that's we've tried to get hundreds of other people, and they've all turned us down, so thank you. That's not true. You're the only person besides my friend Joe LeConte that we have asked, and he will be starting very soon.
It's been a tremendous privilege to join the show. It's not something I'd ever imagined myself doing, but having discovered that I can do it, or that you've encouraged me to do it, it's actually been magnificent and a real thrill.
Well, I think I thought it would be valuable for us to talk about Socrates in the City and about the larger conceit of what it is that Socrates in the City means to do. I want to talk a little bit about how it started, but I also want to talk to you about talking. I want to interview you about interviewing. But there are people maybe who've tuned in who know me who don't know you. So I wanted to ask you just for a minute about yourself. If you can share how you came to be who you are now. I mean, were you a bookish girl?
I was always a bookish girl.
You were?
Yeah. I mean, 5 years ago, 6-7 years ago, I think, I was a mum with a political blog. I was a mum with a political blog.
With a political blog.
Yeah. So I was. I lived in the country. I lived.
You understand how abnormal that is right there? First of all, I've never been a mum. I don't aspire to be a mum. But to have a political blog.
To be clear, I don't say just a mum, because nobody's ever just a mum. It's the most important job in the world. But I was not economically. Being paid to do it.
Okay.
I was mumming, and it was great.
You were a loving mother.
I still am, to be clear.
Right.
But what happened? I mean, I think the first thing that happened was Brexit. The world just went, you know, there was just a lot to talk about. And then my daughter got a little bit older and my husband said to me, you know, do you want to go back to work? And I was like, I can't really think of anything that I actually want to do more than I want to be than spending time with her. So not really. If I don't have to. But then, you know, she got to about 3 and I had a little bit more time and, you know, she gets a little bit, your kid gets a little bit more independent at that point. And there was so much going on and I was a real news junkie. I mean, I still am. I think I've always have been. I was constantly just glued. You know, here I am miming the smart, you know, you're just glued to the feed. Just what's happened now? What are these crazy people doing now?
Yeah.
It was a time, you know, you remember 2016 thereabouts.
I tried to block it out.
It all seems a very long time ago now.
Yeah.
But it was a lot. It was a lot. The two things, you know, for one, the world of politics was going bananas. And two, people were becoming very... politics was going online. And I think that was a much deeper transformation. Perhaps we can get to this a little bit later. It was a much deeper transformation than perhaps people took on board straight away. The fact that politics was going online. It's changed the quality of the discussion. And in the middle of all of that, you know, the battles back and forth over whether or not Brexit was even going to happen. And I remember thinking, well, you know, all of these people writing opinion stuff about it. Now, I'm a decent writer, always have been. I've always, you know, when I've worked for, I was terrible at everything I ever did between leaving university. Literally, I was unemployable by the time I had my daughter.
But you didn't go as far as being incarcerated. You managed to escape. You managed to escape
time,
the long
Eric.
Hand of the law.
So far.
Even now, they could be heard coming
Touch
up
wood.
The steps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
but Jack boots up the stairs.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you know what? Why shouldn't it be me? So I pitched a couple of things, and I got one thing published, and then I got another thing published, and then Unheard, which is the magazine where I'm now a columnist, wrote to me to say would I like to pitch. So I was like, sure. In fact, as it happens, here's one I hadn't been brave enough to send you yet that I wanted to pitch to you. So there you go. And they were like, sure, write it. And so I did. And I think I've written for them most, you know, apart from when I'm on holiday, I've written for them pretty much every week ever since. It was just
a moment. Were you in favor of Brexit?
Yes. I my daughter came campaigning with me in utero.
Yeah. In utero.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Against her will, of course. No, that's interesting.
I mean, I'm not, she may have different views.
Brexit,
about...
from my perspective in the United States, seems so wonderful because I love England. And I guess I think of it some way. There is some parallel, I think, with the idea of the 13 colonies breaking away from England. The idea that England decided it wanted to be England, and I mean that's a larger conversation. We don't need to get into that, but it is interesting because it was portrayed. I guess the global elites, we can call them. That's the nicest word I can think of, the nicest term. But they really look down on the whole idea, and still do, of course.
The central issue of Brexit remains unresolved, or at least it's still being contested, and that was who rules and where, and to whom are they accountable. My view on Brexit at the time was that if we didn't leave soon, our capacity to govern ourselves would become so atrophied that we would no longer have a governing class capable or even inclined to govern from Westminster. And I thought it was possible, the hour was already late, and it was possible that we'd already lost that state capacity, but it was worth a go. For me, the question of whether or not I was right to think we still had a chance that, but you know, there have been times since, much more recently, where I've wondered if actually I was wrong to think that we still had time. I don't know.
I know exactly what you mean.
The question remains unresolved as to whether or not it's still it remains it's workable, and whether or not we can recover that sense of government from and for and by the British Isles for ourselves. Or even whether that's feasible in the world which is unfolding now.
Yeah,
that's a related but you know even much more alarming question.
I've been wondering of course the same thing, and of course many others probably have been. I guess I want to talk to you about talking, or I want to the idea of Socrates in the city. Let's start there. Socrates began. It's very strange, actually, the way it happened. I don't know if I've even told you this, but about 26 years ago, I was a child, of course, but someone asked me, I had just moved back to Manhattan, to New York City, and somebody said, hey, Eric, you know, you're here. Would you like to do a Bible study for seekers, which is the polite term, you know, that people use as though everybody's just champing at the bit to learn more about the Bible. And in the course of discussing this more and more, I thought, I don't know, that seems a strange, you know, it was Oz Guinness, actually, who suggested, why don't you have a forum where we talk about the big questions? Or I don't know if he phrased it that way, but I thought that would be more interesting in a way, because I have this crazy idea that there's such a thing as actual truth, and that if you ask the big questions, honestly, you can find your way, you can grope your way truthward, which is itself an interesting assumption. But Socrates obviously had that assumption, and he was no Christian that I know of. So I guess I wanted to ask you, what do you think of these conversations, or what's behind your thinking? Because we call it Socrates in the City deliberately. It's not meant to be pushing anyone to think anything, but there is an underlying idea that there is truth to be found, which itself is a radical concept in some circles.
It's been a really interesting experience for me to be involved in these dialogues, these spoken word. They're not scripted. You know, I never entirely know what's going to happen in one of these conversations until it happens, and I never completely know what's going to come out of my mouth until it comes. Which is an unusual experience for me, because I've generally been more inclined to think through very carefully and very precisely what I want to say it and say it in writing. So to find myself, you know, ad-libbing much more is fascinating. But what I find incredibly fruitful and profound and rewarding about it is the way in which the truth that you're talking about, or, you know, the shared search for truth between you and your interlocutor in one of these conversations, emerges in a space of relationship between you. And in that respect, actually, if there's something that I draw on, or a place I would reference it to, I would ground my thinking about that. It would be this is another kooky bit of the Mary backstory. I trained as a psychotherapist back in the day. To be clear, I'm not psychoanalyzing you. Or back in the I trained as a psychotherapist.
As a psychotherapist.
I did. And to be clear, I wouldn't presume.
Is there any way I can get out of this?
I wouldn't presume to psychoanalyze any of my guests, least of all someone's...
Yeah, not openly, I know, but go ahead.
And yeah, that's not happening in my mind either. But the central component that you learn as a practitioner in a setting like that is not about theories. I mean, there's all of these baroque theories that you can apply to in the consulting room if you want to, but there's a huge range of them, and lots of them, they all argue with each other, and we don't need to go into any of that. But the evidence for therapy working as such is that it's entirely down to the quality of the relationship. And that's all about the present moment. It's all about the moment of encounter between you and your interlocutor, and it's about the space that you're able to create between you. And to me, there's perhaps something that we can draw from them, perhaps something we can map to the question of how we pursue truth. And actually, this even goes back to Socrates himself, or at least as voiced by Plato. If I remember rightly, it's in the Phaedrus. I think it's the Phaedrus, where he talks about the superiority of speech of dialogue over writing, because the problem with writing, and here I'm doing myself down, is that it can't argue back, it can't be questioned, it just goes running off on its own, and it's not a dialogue, it's just a one-way broadcast, which could be misread, it could be misapplied, it could reach the wrong readers, it could corrupt the youth if it reaches somebody who's not prepared for it. And this is a very different way of communicating meaning, whereas in dialogue, the meaning is created between the two of you all of the time. And I think there's something very deep and very beautiful about seeking to create that space. And it's very clear to me that Socrates in the City aspires to creating that kind of shared meaning making in a tradition which dates all the way back to before Christianity, back to the ancients.
Thank you for not concluding that with the phrase "as it were." It's very important to me that you didn't do that.
I have to tell the Socrates viewers about our first encounter, Eric.
Please do, because I'm sure we were just talking about it before. You remember it better than I do.
You speak to a lot of people. It's what you do. Well. But this was back in 2023, I guess it would have been, when Feminism Against Progress came out. It's the book that I wrote. This was the occasion of our first meeting. And this was in the course of a very, very busy, very programmed set of radio interviews that I did in the US, US media, but from Britain. So I was in the UK dialing into radio shows in the wrong time zone. So it would be 10 o'clock my time, and I'd have done four shows already and be feeling just really weird. And be trying to figure out on the hoof what kind of conversation I was having whilst actually talking. And the conversation I had with you, Eric, is the only one I remember of what was otherwise a total blur. And I just remember thinking, ah, oh, I had an actual encounter there, and like I felt met and seen. There was something that I said somehow.
Yeah,
it felt
and
genuine.
I've always said, you know, if you can fake authenticity, you've got it made. Really, that's
well,
the key.
There you go, Eric.
That's the key.
This is the Metaxas magic. Clearly,
what a wonderful thing for you to say, provided it's true, as it were.
Don't make me do an American accent.
No, this is going to be carnage. It's terrible. But
I actually,
it's worth saying before we get into other things that I have always felt, and it just has something to do with my own personality, but that truth and humor are inextricably intertwined or related, and that there has to be, if not wit, at least joy in the pursuit of truth. And if it isn't there, something's wrong, it seems to me. And again, people can define joy different ways, but it does seem important. It's one of the reasons that we thought you would be one of the many reasons we thought you'd be wonderful as a Socrates in the City contributor. I think that's the official term, contributor.
It's whatever it is, more than
the term contributor. But you and I have talked to so many different people in the last year. Are there any that stick out to you before we get into other things? For me, it's all a blur until somebody reminds me of whom I've spoken with and what we spoke about.
You can't ask me to pick a favorite. They've all.
No,
been
I didn't
marvelous.
Ask you to pick a favorite. No,
I mean there
on
are
on the contrary.
There are moments of dialogue. Who
was a deep disappointment to you of all the you find the least authentic of all of them? Melanie Phillips, right? I'm sure.
No, Melanie was marvelous. I've been incredibly privileged in all of the brilliant thinkers I've been able to speak to so far in my contributions to Socrates in the City. I mean the only points which have been a disappointment are where for some logistical reason or other our conversations have been shorter than we'd hoped.
Right.
The conversation we just recorded one with Carl Truman, which I expect will come out somewhere not too distant future, which was unfortunately short, but we're going to have the rematch later on this year, which I'm so excited about.
Okay,
because this is a wonderful and brilliant mind.
I've been dying to ask you about the mind palace idea. I'd never heard of this before, and I still don't know quite what it is. But can you explain to me and anyone else what this is?
Yeah, I gather from speaking to others on the Socrates team that your approach to interviewing is you just turn up and the conversation flows because you're such a charming and witty and experienced individual, or something like that.
Exactly okay. it. Right. That's exactly it. That okay, will be on my tombstone. No, honestly,
charming.
I think we could talk about that, but
I just want to contrast that with my approach, which is not experienced, and I'm not naturally extroverted, and I'm not good at improvising wildly and it coming out not a disaster. And so, just for the sake of my own peace of mind, I've found so far with these interviews that it helps if I have in mind what it is, roughly where I'd like the conversation to go. It so happened that while I was at the point where I joined Socrates as a contributor, I was also I'm working on a book at the moment, which is about the end of the print era and what happens afterwards. So the age of mass post-literacy is my topic of interest at the moment. What does that look like? What does that do to politics? What does it do to religion? What does it do to culture? What does it do to everything? And in the course of that, I was recommended a book by an historian, a scholar, Mary Carruthers, who writes about the medieval art of memory. And this just absolutely lit up the work that I was doing in the book, because up to that point, to the best of my understanding, the contrast had been between orality, so a culture of the spoken word, you know, as characterized the age before Socrates, really, and illiterate cultures, you know, all the way up to really the printing press, and then literacy, which is to say a culture formed around the capacity to read. And, you know, learning to read is literally mind-altering in that it rewires people's neurology, and it does so permanently. Once you know,
learning to read
rewires your brain. It's literally mind altering,
or literally brain altering.
Yes, it's brain altering, but it's consciousness altering. And once you scale that up, it does very profound things.
So it sounds like I should learn to read. No, seriously, that's very interesting. I'd never heard that.
You've written how many books? I don't know how you did that without learning to read.
Any number of books.
I know, but I have no idea how you did that without learning to read. But
well,
teach me,
it's
Sensei.
Not easy. It's not easy.
Okay, so, but what I sent the draft of some early work I'd done to a friend who's a scholar of the Middle Ages, and he said, "Oh, this is great, but have you read Mary Carruthers?" And I said, "No, who's that?" And he said, "Now she's a scholar of the." He basically told me that there was a piece missing in what I was in my account, which was the middle, the connective tissue between spoken word culture and the culture of literacy, which existed through the entire Middle Ages, really all the way from the arrival of the alphabet circa Plato, all the way up to Gutenberg, which was the art of memory.
This is so fascinating. I mean, I don't tend to think, I've never thought of that, I have to say, and maybe very few people have, to think about these eras, because I care very much about Homer, and there's still no real consensus on when the Iliad and Odyssey were composed or how they were composed. I mean, some people pretend as though, no, we've figured it out, but they haven't quite figured it out. But the concept of people memorizing vast swaths, or is it swathes? How do you say it?
I would say swathes, but perhaps
you would say swathes.
Tomato,
you'd
tomato.
Be wrong, Mary. No, I think
it's a scone.
Either
as well,
way,
not a scone.
It's a lot. It's a big a huge chunk. But that idea is absolutely antithetical to the age in which we live.
It
it's
is
amazing.
Absolutely.
Please continue.
So, I think the important key point is that you're really from Plato onwards. This was already a literate culture, but in a sense which is constrained by the scarcity of reading materials. I mean, if you think about it, before the printing press, every text has to be written by hand.
Right.
Vellum is scarce. Vellum is precious. Nobody's invented paper
yet. I don't have any.
I don't have. You're right. It's skin,
right.
Specially treated, scraped thin and flat.
Yeah.
It's incredibly expensive. Every single book is. I mean, it's like a Titian. It's a work. It's like an old master in terms of the labor and the value and the sheer preciousness of it. And in the course of exploring all of this, there's an account of Saint Wilfrid, who was an early English saint who founded a monastery in England in Anglo-Saxon times. And he goes off to Rome, and he comes back with a scripture that's beautifully bound, covered in jewels, and illuminated in letters of purest gold. And you've got to picture these books. They're not you know, the paperback that you chuck in your suitcase or to read on the plane, or you know. These are treasures. Mm. They're incredibly rare and precious things. Mm. But if you think about how, as a scholar, as an aspirant scholar, you would relate to those, you might get one go on it in your lifetime. You know, you have to travel arduously for months to get to the location where this treasure exists, and then you have a limited period of time where you can engage with this marvelous thing.
And that's something that is certainly not sufficiently appreciated.
And
what
you
an
can't
idea!
Take notes.
What
you,
an idea!
You can't take notes because, I mean, what are you going to write them on?
You can't take notes.
So what do? You learn to remember. And what they and this is a skill which was developed really in classical times. You know, it was the foundation for statesmanship in the Roman Empire, was the ability to remember and to compose mentally your speeches, and then to be able to deliver them as though you were just coming out with it off the cuff, but you'd actually prepared. And the foundation of that was the art of memory. And this is a visualization practice. I think the classical version, the best known classical account of it is by Quintilian, who I think is early in the around the 3rd century AD, I think. But somebody more knowledgeable can correct me on that. Anyway, any Quintilian experts out there can correct me on it, because I'm reaching a little bit here. But he suggests that what you should do is visualize a building, a room that you know well. So it can be an actual place. And then every idea in the sequence of ideas that you want to expound, that you want to store, should be visualized in one of the locations in that room. And then you always move around it in the same direction. And you visualize each of the elements that you want to remember in a place,
in
your mind.
Is this a room, an actual room from one's life?
Yes, it can be.
It's not an imaginary room.
No.
It's a room from one's actual life.
This is the classical approach. Yeah. So you could imagine your house and or your garden or a walk you do regularly.
Yeah.
And because you always move around that imaginary space in the same direction, it means you can remember the order. And because you've stored the information visually, it's much denser and much easier to recall the totality of that of that idea.
Yeah.
So this was just the foundation of memorizing, and what the medieval monastics got the hang of over time. They developed an incredibly sophisticated memorization practice. So St. Wilfrid, who we were talking about just now, so he goes off to Rome to get books. While he's there, he didn't just memorize the entire Book of Psalms. He already had that. That's like table stakes.
What?
He had the whole Book of Psalms.
You must be kidding.
No. Not even that, Eric. It's more crazy than that. He updated his edition of the Book of Psalms in his memory while he was there to the latest version.
I don't think this can be put down to some fancy technique. I think this is just some people are outrageously gifted.
This was relatively unusual, I think, in the 8th century AD. But by the 12th, this was table stakes. You know, the kids entering, you know, and entering
every 4-year old had memorized the Psalms.
By the time you were, if you were being sent, if you were joining, if you were expected to become a monastic, learning the book, memorizing the Book of Psalms was table stakes. It was kids' stuff. It was like learning your multiplication
table.
Honestly,
this is news to me, and I'm not going to pretend not to be astonished.
And what the way they did it was it became progressively more abstract. So you would they would visualize a numbered series stretching off into infinity, and the first stage in would just be to practice, visualize, jumping back and forth from 1 to 8 to 9 to 12. And once you could do that consistently, you would place different ideas, 1 to 8 to 9 to 12, and visualize hopping about between those points and retaining which one belonged where. And then once you could get the hang of doing it in a line, you could do it in a grid. And once you could do it in a grid, you could do it in a three-dimensional grid. And these guys had held entire three-dimensional spreadsheets full of visualized ideas in their minds. So William of Ockham, I think 14th century, 13 something, if I remember rightly, thereabouts. He was sent into exile for being rude to the Pope or something like that. And
to cut him with a razor.
I mean, it was bad. Whatever it was, the Pope was upset. He was not allowed to take any of his books with him. He was sent into exile without any of his reading material. And he did most of his most important work in exile from what he had stored in his mind. And he says at some point in one of his letters, I advise any young scholar to make sure they did use metaphors like the treasure house or the honeycomb or the, you know, they, I forget the medieval Latin word, but a sort of money pouch that people would carry with them. You know, you must make sure that this is well stocked so that you can take it with you anywhere you go. And even if you don't have your books, you'll have ready access to everything you need to think with. When I discovered this, it completely lit up the Middle Ages for me. It made sense. The whole culture just and why it feels.
Did you want the Middle Ages to be lit up for you?
Of course. I mean, I love discovering different ways of thinking about the world, and I think it really shed light for me on why that culture feels so different and so difficult to get your head in, difficult to grasp for one of us, for a modern now. Why it feels, I don't want to say alien, but in some respects, actually, yeah, alien. You know, we look at those illuminated marginalia, that the funny little creatures and the weird homunculi the guys with eyes in their stomachs or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the pointing hands or the funny, or like the gross bits.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize until I read Carruthers that all of these are all aids to memory. They're there in the margin because somebody has, this passage next to it is really important.
Does Mary Carruthers write about that?
Yes. Yes,
she does.
It's a great book.
Think of the title of her book?
It's called The Book of Memory.
It's called The Book of Memory.
The Book of Memory.
If only I could remember that. Really?
Maybe we'll put it in the show notes.
Mary Carruthers. Well, no, but that's just, it's extraordinary and a little overwhelming to me to think that civilization for many centuries existed in some part because of people who were able to do this.
It's kind of mind-blowing. And, it's really mind-blowing.
And also, I guess, related to that is just the idea that we don't, or at least most of us don't. Sounds like you do to some extent.
Only as a thought experiment. And I read this, and I was so fascinated by what she's describing that I thought, well, I'm going to try it. And it so happened that I was kindly invited by these marvelous people at Socrates in the City to come and do these conversations. And I'm thinking my usual approach to ideas is much more solitary. I'm a nerd who lives in a cupboard full of books. Facilitated by the printing press, I should say. And I'll think through I'll deliberate and then put down in writing what it is that I want to say. I can't do that in one of these conversations. So how am I going to, you know, if it's my responsibility to guide the conversation and to keep it flowing and to ensure that spark of relationality and the encounter is made possible, I'm going to have to think of some way of storing the themes that I want to. So I thought, oh, this is a great opportunity to experiment with the medieval mind palace. So I mean, it's pretty primitive. You know, I don't have an eight-dimensional Noah's Ark spreadsheet in my mind or anything like that. But what I do is I visualize 10 to 15. I have 10 to 15 locations on my usual morning dog walk. I'm describing a circle in the air because it's a loop.
So wait, so for you use your
my dog
morning
walk.
Dog
I use my morning
walk.
Dog walk. It's a very beautiful walk. It's around a local woodland. And there are familiar locations which are distinct enough. You know, it's not just a tree, or you know, there's a bench, or there's a place where one of my nieces lost a gumboot in a puddle. And you're right, there's just like little specific, or there's a little bridge, then this and that. And each of those sort of has its own character. And because I walk past it every day, I can picture it very clearly. And in each of those locations, I'll prepare my questions in writing, and then I'll abstract from the written question an image which encodes the ideas. You know, and usually the weirder and sillier and more surreal the image, the more easy it is to remember. Mm-hmm.
It just be easier for you to jot your notes down on a piece of paper, I may have done here?
Well, yes, in theory, but also no, because if I have to look away from, you know, if somebody is speaking to me, and I have to look away.
Yes.
There's a moment of interruption
exactly.
In the conversation. Whereas if I have in my mind, as you know, I'm thinking, okay, well, what's next on the dog walk? And it's just a picture, because it's in pictures, not words. It doesn't interrupt the flow of conversation, but it also helps to shape where and how I respond and where I think I'm. You know, we might move the conversation next and how. And it just for me, it makes it. I feel reassured because I'm not going to panic and go blank. And
I think only people who would never panic and go blank would worry about panicking and going blank.
Oh, you say that, but one of the most traumatic experiences of my life was delivering, was when I had to do a talk in front of my class as part of the GCSE English curriculum. This is just, you know, one of those moments that I still wake up in a cold sweat, you know, the sort of thing that gives you nightmares for years. And I prepared and I was supposed to stand, and it was recorded. And I stood up in front of the classroom and I was just like, I couldn't do it. Just completely corpsed, froze, went blank. It was awful. And for years, like all the way from the age of 16 to the age of 40 something, I was completely sure that I was terrible at public speaking. And somehow or other, I do a lot of that now, and it's fine and it's fun. It turns out that actually the difference is the difference is if you're talking about something that you're interested in and feel passionate about, then you just never run out of things to say. And apparently that's the secret, but.
Well, in fact, we're talking about talking, we're conversing about conversing, which was the point of this, really, because that's what Socrates is. And Socrates, I guess we've called it, or I've called it, Conversations on the Examined Life. He, you know, famously said, the unexamined life is not worth living. So I thought these would be conversations on the examined life. So they're meant to be conversations, which is why I think many people who watch them on YouTube who are unaware of that, who are thinking of it, it's an interview, are upset if the person presumably doing the interview is interrupting.
Which one of us
interrupts
most? And
you've been very, very guilty of that, Mary. And I brought you here to talk to you about that and also to say that I've been far more guilty of it. Hey there, folks. For over 25 years, Socrates in the City and I, yours truly, have been having wonderful conversations with some of the leading minds of our time on the big questions. We think that what we're doing is important and we need your help. Would you go to SocratesInTheCity.com/donate this month? This month, we're doing a matching campaign. All of your donations are doubled. SocratesInTheCity.com/donate. It's very important we get this out, what we do, to the widest possible audience. And your help makes it possible for us to do that. Also, while you're at SocratesInTheCity.com, please feel free to sign up for our newsletter and tell us what conversations you've enjoyed the most and what conversations you'd like to see in the future. Thank you. But what's interesting is there are times when genuinely you feel like, yes, I need to resist the urge to interrupt. But there are other times when I think interruption is important because it's not interruption, it's conversation. It's the way, I mean, maybe the problem in a way is that everybody converses differently. Some people don't interrupt. In my family or the way we're all high energy and so there's no objective standard whether something is an interruption or an annotation.
I think if you come from a family of recreational arguers, which not everybody does,
yeah,
then it feels, you know, it doesn't feel like an interruption. It's just knocking the ball back. You know, you're playing a vigorous game of tennis, and there's no shade if you lob the ball back. It's just part of the thing. But not everybody engages like that. So which one of us interrupts more? You can interrupt me and tell me that now.
I just was waiting for you to finish interrupting me so I could answer the question, and I can't believe that you finally stopped. The other thing that I've noticed is that depending on whom one is interviewing or conversing with, there's sometimes an expectation on the part of the audience. There are people who will tune in just because I'm interviewing or talking to someone they love, I mean, Jordan Peterson or whomever. And for those people, usually anytime I talk, they think of it as an interruption. Just shut up and let them talk because they just want to hear him or her or it. We've had four its. I won't say who they were, but you'll know them. But no, honestly, it is so strange to me because I've noticed in the comments, the YouTube comments, that there are certain folks who have a huge following, and if people tune into my conversation with that person, they regard my conversation as interruption. So I think that's part of the dynamic.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's clearly not the case. I mean, I've been privileged to be invited to join enough conversations with enough other interviewers to know that not all interviewers are alike. You know, it's not as though when you have a conversation like that that the point is just for you to emit.
Yeah.
You know, the themes emerge in dialogue. And of course, a skilled interview is expert at drawing that out whilst. I mean, if the aim is really just to invite the person to talk, then a skilled interviewer will be as in the background as possible while still keeping it going. But I mean, Socrates' dialogues is a dialogue. So I don't know. I suppose I'd never really given it much thought. You know, there are times when I have to frame a question. I have to say a few more things than just nothing at all. And you know, I've had feedback from actually one of my guests in particular, who had a book and who told me he was promoting a book and was quite tired of doing interviews to promote the book at the point where we had our conversation, and told me that she'd enjoyed the conversation because one I'd actually read it, which isn't always the case, and two, they weren't the usual questions. So I don't know. I don't feel at all embarrassed about being present in the conversation as well, you know, as well as being there to listen.
You couldn't have possibly used your Mind Palace gimmick today. Did you?
No.
Have you been dog walking in your mind while we're having this conversation?
No, I don't have a set of questions prepared.
You didn't come here armed.
No,
I didn't come here
to interrogate you, Eric. I mean, if I...
No, we both came to interrogate other people who haven't shown up. It's really sad. Yeah. We scared them away with all of our interruptions.
I think that's what it is.
And good riddance. No, we have... I'm trying to think. We've been so thrilled to have you as part of the team, Mary. I want to say that. And I want to say that I think both of us obviously believe that talking and thinking about what we've called the big questions is important. So maybe I'll ask you, I don't know if this has an answer or if could have an answer, why you think it's important, because you obviously do. You wouldn't be writing all the things you write and doing all the talking that you do if you didn't think it was important. But why?
Well, I suppose everything I do, everything I write rests on the premise that there is a there at the most fundamental level. I mean, I think going back a little bit to the Mary Harrington crazy years, of which there were many, but the really crazy years before I even trained as a psychotherapist, so I was just like full
how
on.
How crazy? What were you doing during the crazy years?
I was between leaving university and about the age of 30, I was various kinds of commune dwelling, crazy post-structuralist, rabid protest going.
Really?
Odd haircut. Bisporting kind of lefty art weirdo, sort of living hand to mouth and just being useless at everything.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, turning, yeah, I was just a kind of feral art geek. But during the crazy, I think the reason I was so crazy, I mean, there were many reasons why I was crazy, but I think but the thing that really tipped me over the edge, and I'm sure I've told this story before, was encountering post-structuralists at university, so all the postmodern theories, you know, who all of which begins from the premise that there isn't really a there, it's all just language and power all the way down.
Could there be anything more cynical?
Right, I mean, I've since come to the conclusion that the post-structuralists weren't wrong about everything, in the sense that, you know, reality really is partly constructed, but through language.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't follow from that that there's no there. It doesn't follow from that that there isn't a reality
there.
That
there isn't a ground of all being.
Yeah, exactly. That there isn't a ground of all being. And if you add that back in, actually, post-structuralism becomes something that's, I think, spiritually very very alive and very beautiful, and the world comes to life in a way which is actually profoundly, just astonishingly, miraculously life-giving. You can map this idea of the aliveness of ideas onto the truth that there's a there, then you come out somewhere that's actually marvelous, and you don't have to go back to this idea that actually reality is dead and inert and just made of atoms. You know, the world comes alive in a way which actually, funnily enough, looks a great deal like the world that the medievals lived in. You know, at least it has it rhymes with the world of the medievals,
which makes me think of C.S. Lewis.
That's right.
Who was a medievalist,
and he saw this written. Actually, his close friend Owen Barfield, another one of the Inklings, also saw this, and he wrote a wonderful book. I mean, it's dense and it's rather dry. He's not as good a writer. He's not as good a writer as C.S. Lewis, but very few people are. And he wrote a book. Why is my mind gone blank? Why can't I remember the title of it? It'll come back to me. But he wrote a book about the evolution of thought and the evolution of our relationship to reality. Over the ages and through modernity, he thought we'd come to idolize our capacity to abstract from it. That we'd created an idol out of abstraction and out of the deadening and inertness and our detachment from the world. And in his view, downstream of quantum theory, this was simply no longer philosophically tenable, and that we were going to come back by degrees to a more participatory relationship to the world in conjunction with that capacity to detach from it, which seemed to me, I mean, it was very prescient.
It sounds like that's what you're saying when you're saying that post-structuralism can have value as long as we realize
that there's a there.
That there's a there.
Yeah. I'll remember the title and I'll put it in the show notes for anybody who's
infuriated. It's not The Sound of the Fury, is it?
It's not, no.
Just guessing. It's not. That's so interesting. Lewis, it is interesting to think of. I mean, I rarely think of the medieval world. Not only am I not a medievalist, I'm not somebody who thinks much about the medieval world, but I'm fascinated that Lewis was, in fact, a medievalist. Because we think of him as the Christian apologist and the author of the Narnia Chronicles, which are a different kind of apologetics. But that he was a medievalist, that's what explains him in a way.
It does. One of my favorite lines from Lewis, he wrote a fabulous book about, he called it The Discarded Image. See, I remembered that title.
Yeah.
The Discarded, which is about the medieval worldview. And it's really written as a primer for students of medieval literature. It's one of the last books he wrote. Or just about the medieval worldview. And he explores important like Boethius and various other important texts of the age. Mm-hmm. And one of the lines I most love, which actually speaks to the Mind Palace, he says, of all modern inventions that he thinks the medieval scholars would most have appreciated the card index, because they were great systematizers and they were great tabulators of things into their mind palace, mm-hmm. which was very methodical, right. Grid based.
It's funny to think that we don't have. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, the card indexes in libraries, that all libraries were filled with these. I can't even think of the name of what they were called.
I know those little boxes,
catalog?
And then you, yeah,
the card catalog, yes. And to think that we've moved past that, and there's something I've always been bothered with everything being digitized and existing in the wherever it exists. Mm. I don't know where it exists. I'm not really hostile to that, but the idea that it doesn't also exist on paper someplace, maybe that's just old fashioned and silly, but I think what it brings us to is the question of whether we're intended to be grounded in something, that if you don't have a piece of paper or a book, where
does this stuff even exist? Where is it even?
Well,
you see, one of my working hypotheses for the book I'm working on at the moment about the age after the print age, which is really where we already definitively are now.
Mm-hmm.
The title is The King and the Swarm. So it's about the politics and the culture of the age after the digital revolution. And one of my working hypotheses, drawn from an American thinker and in Marshall McLuhan's tradition, called Mark Stahlman, whose line is that digital retrieves the medieval, and that there are aspects of what the culture of information, the culture in general looks like after the print age, which rhymes much more closely with the medieval world than it does with the world that Gutenberg created. I think one of the ways in which I think that's true is that the dematerialization of our tools for memory. I mean, what print did was allow us to it allowed scholars in the early modern era to externalize the material which previously they just stored in their minds.
Is we don't now store it in our minds. That's
right.
That's the
whole
idea.
Store it anywhere.
Right. Well, it can be what we store it in the cloud. We can retrieve it, but it's the exact opposite. In other words, not only are we not encouraged to memorize anything.
That's absolutely right.
We're discouraged from even thinking.
That's right. And what's potentially, I think, a grave risk in that particular setup is that whereas with a physical library, you can externalize your memory into a physical book, you know, I've got plenty of them at home on the floors and chairs and under the bed, just everywhere. Once the text is there and it's printed, it doesn't change. Whereas once text is stored in a digital space and not in our minds and not in a printed book, it can change. And then at that point, what we refer to becomes fluid in a way which is really unsettling. You know, newspaper articles can be rewritten. Wikipedia entries can be updated on the we're already seeing the politics of this, aren't we?
Yes.
You know, everywhere, all the time. There's a sense that reality has become very sort of slippery underneath us. And there's no there's no very trustworthy digital authority that we can refer to and say this is definitively the case. I mean, people reach for AI as a way of as an arbiter of truth in that way. But it's already clear that those AI models which are trained on material on the internet can be gamed and are being gamed because they. So, for example, if they draw their truth from, say, Wikipedia, then all you have to do if you're canny and this is already happening, this is very visibly intentionally happening, is that people will set out to capture the editorial processes for political, highly politicized issues that they care about and ensure that their line is propagated through Wikipedia, because then that's picked up by the LLMs and that then becomes the arbiter of truth. So there is no trustworthy source anymore that can't be gamed on the fly, that everything has all that is solid melts into air, as somebody notorious once said. That was Karl Marx.
I know. What did Karl Marx say?
All that is not solid that I... melts into air.
Into air.
Including the things that we thought were written down and that we could therefore rely on. And one of the ideas I've been playing with and exploring is that actually the only sure refuge we have from this is actually to resume cultivating our memories. I'm going to set out to store this in my own mind, such that the Wikipedia entry can be edited, but what's in here can't. And to be much more intentional about telling our stories, memorizing poems, memory maxing. And deliberately setting out to cultivate that capacity, not least as a hedge against the total evacuation of inner life into this very sort of hyper-connected space where it's difficult to distinguish between what it is I'm thinking and what, for example, the latest social media panic is thinking in me.
Do you write about this in this new book?
Uh-huh.
You do?
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I mean, there's a great deal else there besides, but this is one of
Well, it seems to me, unfortunately, extremely important. So I'm glad that you're talking about it now, and I'm glad that you're writing about it, and I want to get my hands on the Mary Carruthers book, which title...
It will absolutely blow your mind. The Book of Memory.
Yeah. Oh, The Book of Memory. Mm-hmm. Oh, that title we did remember, although I had temporarily forgotten it. So, no, but the Book of Memory by Mary Carruthers, it just seems very important to me and seems related to everything we've been talking about. Well, you've interrupted quite enough, and I'm going to end this conversation, Mary. I've had it. I have my limits. I'm patient, but that's it. I just want to draw the line here and say thank you very much. I do. We're so grateful to you for being a part of the team. That's what we call it, the team, and I look forward to talking to you much more about many other things. But for all of the interviews you've done, and for this time now, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure and a privilege, and continues to be so. Thank you, Eric.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.